Hello and welcome to another episode of Over Under Movies, the podcast in which we pick one overrated and one underrated movie, connected through the same style, story, narrative, or however we see fit. I am Oktay Ege Kozak.
I'm Ryan Oliver.
And I am Kenji Fujishima.
Hey, and we have Kenji as our guest critic on this episode. And we have Kenji's picks, which are, I guess we'll get into it, but I guess they're kind of tied into with the theme of American capitalism, early 20th century American capitalism, and how this country got this way through maybe greed or good old-fashioned ingenuity, or So we have two films about two incredibly ambitious figures who went out into their own way and made things happen, but they have, you know, vastly different approaches to how they deal with the characters. Kenji's overrated pick is a little bit of a controversial one, but I think it's going to open it up to some interesting discussion. It is Paul Thomas Anderson's 2007 oil drilling drama and allegory about milkshakes, There Will Be Blood.
If you have a milkshake, and I have a milkshake, and I have a straw, there it is. That's a straw, you see. Watch it. And my straw reaches across the room and starts to drink your milkshake. I drink your milkshake. I drink it up.
So Kenji, without further ado, why'd you pick There Will Be Blood as overrated?
Well, let me just say that I remember struggling with this film a lot when it came out, and even now I still kind of struggle with the film, because I certainly admire the skill and the technique and the performance. I admire a lot of things about There Will Be Blood, and we can certainly talk about all of the various aspects of this film. But I think ultimately for me, what it comes down to is that I still struggle to, and even then I still kind of struggle to, I guess, understand what it is about. It's like grand themes that people found revelatory, insightful. I mean, I'm very much, the movie still even now impresses me with the aesthetic force with which it, like, it explores this character, Daniel Plainview. But I also feel that feel like what Anderson is trying to get at about capitalism is kind of a cliche that filmmakers like Orson Welles with Citizen Kane had already explored, I think, to much greater effect. And I mean, Anderson obviously has his own way of doing it, and some of the really weird ways he does it in this film are really interesting. But I find what it has to say about its grand subjects kind of banal, and I especially, and we can talk more about this later, but I especially am troubled by its attitude towards religion, especially with the Eli Sunday character. It's always rankled me the what I find kind of cheap derision toward religion. That, like, I mean, I'm not a religious man myself, so like I understand what he's saying about how much of a snake oil salesman Eli Sunday is. But I also feel that it strikes me as very much preaching to a certain kind of liberal choir in certain ways that kind of have always kind of rankled me, even though I understand in this context how, like, that character's, like, function, like, in the narrative and in, like, Daniel Plainview's life as this kind of nemesis. And I mean, I get the fact that Plainview is a much more honest about his one track mind than Eli Sunday is, and to some degree that's where their dynamic gets their
And I think that's what infuriates him, is that he knows that he's as much of a charlatan as he is, but he sees that at least he's being kind of, I mean, he's a duplicitous prick as well in many ways, but yeah. He sees that he sees through him. He sees the kind of wolf in sheep's clothing. They're both made out of the same cloth. So I think, aside from having any kind of religious significance or what it says about religion in general, which I don't think it really says that much about religion in general, I think what Tom Anderson is saying basically is that people like this will hang on to anything that could be used to control people to get what they want. So basically, like Daniel Plainview was using HW to make it look like he has this like loving, stable family, so that he can approach his marks and tell them, like, you know, it starts the first time you hear any dialogue, it's him like basically going on and on about like how much of a family man he is and how normal he is, just like the rest of them. And he isn't. He is like, he's a beast, as he says with that famous monologue about like how much he hates people and there's a competition in him. And it kind of shows that, like, I don't think it's specifically about religion, but it shows that people like Daniel and Eli will use anything at their disposal to kind of lull the, let's say, not so smart and intuitive public to go with whatever they want to do. Just getting politically for like a second, just as an example, like, I don't think anybody with even a little bit of a cynical mind who can look at the logic of things believes that like Donald Trump is a Christian, like as a devout Christian. Yeah, but he is like that character. He's like, he's totally using that as a thing to manipulate people, and a lot of politicians do as well. So I think I kind of look at it from that perspective, like in a very specific perspective, from like what American capitalism or America, the American dream, quote unquote, opened up the floodgates to that kind of a personality, where these types of things can be manipulated to be used by people for their own kind of selfish gains. But what do you think about that aspect of it, Ryan? Do you think the film is kind of very easily preaching to the liberal, like atheist, agnostic choir, or, you know, is it about something bigger?
I mean, I think it's a little bit about something bigger. I don't necessarily see it preaching to the choir, because, I mean, you have the duality that, I think, as you said, that sort of wolf in sheep's clothing that both Eli and Daniel Plainview have. But I think, like, being such a good, like, nemesis for the competition that Plainview sees in himself, like, not only does Eli represent, in Plainview's eyes, a phony, but also, like, Plainview's, like, thirst for power, like, goes beyond man. Like his thirst for being in power just goes so far beyond man that he really doesn't even want to stop till he's conquered God. Which is how I sort of have read the ending, like, when, you know, the whole bowling pin scene happens.
It's more
that
of
he
a
is
primal
now,
morality tale.
Right, yeah,
really.
That now he is transcended, in his mind. Now he is transcended, and he has conquered both God and man. And so that's ultimately what I've seen of it. And even though, like, you know, both characters are, you know, inherently not great people, I think there's still an empathy for the Eli character. I mean, because the Plainview character is so relentlessly, you know, evil in the way that, like, he's, again, he has no transparency over who he is. Like, we see who he is from the entire time. So I think there's a little bit of empathy with the other character. Cause, you know, myself not being a super religious person either, I do empathize a little bit, just because there are certain scenes where I'm just like, he's just outmatched completely. You know, like, don't bully me, Daniel. I'm going to bury you in the ground, Eli. Like, you know, stuff like that. It's just like, it does make you empathize just a little bit with that character. So I've never seen it as preaching too hard to that liberalist view, because I feel like both characters get a pretty fair shake in terms of what they're both about and where their flaws lie.
It's quite possible you may have a bit more empathy for Eli Sunday than I could work up.
That's yeah, fair
me,
enough.
Me neither. Actually.
Sure, sure.
It's hard to, whatever empathy I have for him is basically comes from, you know, I don't believe for a second that he actually is as religious as he says he is. Maybe he has a certain amount of belief in God and the Bible that like kind of propelled him to be like, hey, I can use this to like kind of sucker people into my own way of like, he's really trying to like use this, the oil well that comes into town as like a springboard to for like to create his giant congregation, almost like he's almost like the original one of those like evangelical preachers who like who have like these giant churches and like travel and like jets and stuff. He's almost like the he's almost like the granddaddy of them, and that's what he wants to do. And it's like the sympathy doesn't come, empathy doesn't come from that. My empathy for him comes from the fact that, just like you said, Ryan, he's insanely outmatched from the very beginning. So every time he like goes after Daniel Plainview and tries to do like a tete-a-tete, you just kind of go like, dude, you're gonna get fucked out of this. Like, don't do it. Just like do your own. Like you, it's like that kind of like in a horror movie. It's like, yeah, don't go into the cabin kind of thing.
Right.
Where you like talk to the spirit. You're just like, don't do this. Like, this is not going to end well for you. And of course it doesn't. But it's hard to have empathy for him beyond that.
Sure.
But at least you get that kind of empathy. It's Daniel Plainview is almost like that. Like the film itself, I can kind of understand why people have issues with connecting with it emotionally, as much as like Kenji saying how like aesthetically how beautiful the cinematography is and the
very imposing in that. Yes, it's very imposing.
But it's almost like the tone of the film reflects Daniel Plainview's nihilism in a way that like I don't think the film itself cares whether you like it or not. It's about like, it's just showing you in kind of a blunt force what this character stands for, what he's trying to get out of his life, and how he's going to just destroy everybody, including his son, to get what he wants, to get his way. And that's not pleasant. That's not likable in any way. But in some ways, there are these people exist by like millions. Whether or not they're rich or not, there are people who are like working class and middle class who have this personality. So I really like attached to that aspect of it. But I do understand, like, Kenji, do you kind of feel that way, that you can't like emotionally connect with the film because of this kind of cold attitude that it has, almost like Kubrickian? Like, it reminds me of
Which that does, that's not so much where like my problems with it. Like, I don't mind that aspect, because I mean, I like Kubrick as much as the next guy, and I've never really had that much problem with his like chilly attitude towards characters. I mean, obviously each filmmaker is different and has different personalities, and to force every filmmaker to conform to what you prefer for a movie is like, that would be just like very limiting. But I think what it is for me with There Will Be Blood, like his Anderson's approach in There Will Be Blood, is that I think you talk about like, this is a very specific story about a very specific character and his worldview. And I mean, Anderson does to a considerable degree align with his main character. It's like he's kind of playing like a balancing act between like kind of standing outside but also trying to like inhabit it to some degree. And the thing is, there are things about like the way he's characterized in the movie that that some people might consider like mysterious, but I've always felt kind of like under-imagined and under, for instance, that speech that classic speech he gives about the "I see nothing worth liking in people," that speech, like,
nice,
I mean,
nice voice, by the way.
Thanks. I've worked on it many years. The thing is that like the movie doesn't, at least perhaps you guys have different opinions on this, but for me the movie doesn't really, it sticks so closely to Plainview's perspective that it doesn't, I don't quite grasp where this this misanthropy came from. And I mean, I don't necessarily demand movies like dot every I or T in like characterization. I mean, to explain these characters, but it's always kind of, for me at least, frustrated me. Like, to some degree, it feels to me like Anderson just had this idea, this kind of monstrous horror movie main character, and you do get some nuances within what he shows you, but I also feel like there's perhaps it sticks so closely to its perspective that it doesn't feel as rich to me in that regard. Like, it doesn't really have that many other perspectives, like, other than, like, I guess that one scene in which Eli attacks his dad during dinner time while he has mud caked on his face. Other than that, it sticks so closely to Plainview that I feel it's a bit limiting in what it says in the grand themes it tries to tackle.
The fact that it sticks so close to him, that is completely from his perspective, and the kind of damp, dark, very kind of morbid, but beautiful in many ways, cinematography or the style that it has, kind of reflects that as well. And I do think it is very much, like, mostly apart from like one or two scenes, it's very much from his perspective, and you almost see people from that perspective as well. Like, everybody is just a sucker to be taken advantage of, or everybody is, or like a pawn in a game that, yeah, or a bureaucrat. Everybody's a pawn in the game that should be used, and it's almost like they are depicted that way. So I can see why that could be kind of harder to get behind for some people, mainly because it is a, like I said, I think the film kind of captures Plainview's worldview as well. It's almost like the film itself is almost as nihilistic as he is. And it's like, well, this is like people are morons, and then there's the moron, there's a sheep, and then there will always be a wolf who comes in and like takes advantage of them. And it's almost like, in a very plain, universal, primal sense, the film is about, it almost kind of, to me, it almost transcends the specifics of, you know, you said specifically it's a very personal story of like Daniel Plainview, is specifically about him, or specifically about like a turn of the 20th century American capitalism, all that stuff, which it is about all of that. But in a way, because of its raw power, it almost kind of transcends that to me and becomes a fable or a morality tale, a human tale about like how primal we still are in many ways. We have just basically, a lot of us have dropped the spears and the shields and picked up, you know, bank books and banking books and the economy and numbers, and that there really isn't that much of a difference between the two. And in the way, the ending kind of solidifies that, the shocking ending, where a lot of people are like, I can't believe it ended that way. And in a way, like, my reaction to everybody saying that was like, it couldn't have ended any other way. Like, it was inevitable that it was going to get there. So I kind of have that kind of attitude towards it, in the way that the fact that it is a bit of a, I don't want to say single dimensional, but I don't, like you said, you said that he's trying to like build some kind of a mystery behind him, but I don't think that's his intention at all. From the very first scene on, you know exactly what this guy is about. You know that he's never going to stop to get what he wants, because the first scene is basically him mining, breaking his leg, and dragging himself across in the desert, across like how many miles to get his money. Like, that's insane. Like, and then he makes a point of like seeing him like dragging himself and like kind of tilting up to see like how long of like, he's just looking at like miles and miles of like nothing, just flat desert and mountains. And from that first scene alone, he's showing you like, this guy is not going to stop. He's a machine. He's not going to stop getting whatever he wants at any cost. And it does become kind of a parable about American capitalism, but it also becomes like kind of a like a morality tale, like a human tale, in many ways. And that's what I love about it. Yeah, but I do see that if you look at it from this kind of like specific storytelling perspective, where it's about, you know, let's try to like dig more into this character. Why did he become this way? Why does he act this way? You get a couple of hints here and there about like his family and how like basically disrupted or broken his family was. And that you get hints at. I love the subplot about his quote unquote brother. You know, not to spoil too much because of the. I love that subplot because it is the one subplot that shows, even beyond his relationship with his son, it is the one subplot that shows that maybe he is looking for something beyond his own ambition, and this brother figure, more than like his son, who he doesn't actually have a blood connection to, just kind of makes him feel like, yeah, maybe I could use with some kind of company, some kind of family, some kind of human connection.
And then that revealed kind of destroys his last ounce of potential goodwill towards humanity.
It completely eviscerates it. Anyway, Ryan, do you want to jump in?
No, I mean, that's really all I had in terms of that. And the thing I would say from it being, from his perspective, I don't disagree with anything being said, but that's why I like it. I like those type of character studies where it's like completely from their perspective and like you get to know what the character's all about. I mean, my favorite movie of all time is Taxi Driver, so it's a very like similar, just like completely.
Yeah, that only
from...
has a single scene, just one scene, and I always think that it could have been taken out.
Yeah, yeah.
The dancing with Jodie Foster and Harvey Keitel.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's grody, so it could be taken out. But yeah, other than that, everything's from Travis Bickle's perspective. The same way that, other than the Eli confronting his dad, pretty much everything, like there's not a single scene that doesn't have Daniel Plainview in it. But I mean, these are the type of character studies that I enjoy, so but I completely see where you're coming from on that end.
And I mean, I admire certain movies like that too, which is I guess why ultimately like my stance on this movie is more like ambivalent rather than like,
for sure,
I don't like this movie. Like, I mean, again, like, I see what it's doing, but I also feel like, and this is obviously, it's like, this could just be my own perspective speaking. Like, it's like, for me, I'm not sure I find that much value in being put in the perspective of this, like, misanthrope who hates humanity and just wants to get away from everyone, especially when, like, I always wonder how did he get this way, and there are not that many scenes that show. You see, obviously, when like in that early scene, like when he like that first when we first hear Plainview speak, and you see all those people reacting to what he says about like about trying to drill for oil in their town, and he's like, well, like, screw this, and then he walks away. And I mean, you can certainly feel the like the frustration in Plainview, and so like I get that, like it puts you in that headspace, but I don't know. I guess I just, for me, I feel like it's easy to be cynical, and I mean, especially the way the world is these days, it's like I perhaps do I'm much easier perhaps on like cynical movies than perhaps I used to be, but I feel like cynicism is easy, and it's harder to, but it's harder to like, I guess empathy is a bit, it's harder. And I mean, which is why, as far as Paul Thomas Anderson goes, and he's had empathy, like his filmography is full of like, he's capable of like a more kind of warm-hearted empathy, which is
earlier in his early work, I would say, definitely.
Well, even Inherent Vice has a lot Inherent of Vice, like, warm-hearted
and
empathy.
I was gonna say that, and as far as empathy goes, this is why I've always kind of preferred The Master to There Will Be Blood, because I feel it's kind of like him doing the best of both worlds stylistically, is that you have that same kind of weird detachment that Anderson exudes in There Will Be Blood. But I think the view of Lancaster Dodd and Freddie Quill, that relationship, is, to me at least, And that, to me, like, I was like, it's like, I think it's in its own weird way a warmer film, and I think, like, as far as,
do you think that might have something to do with the performances, like Philip Seymour Hoffman, Joaquin Phoenix's performances? I feel like are more emotionally empathetic and complex in a way that which is, you know, if it was like that in There Will Be Blood, I think it would have taken a lot out of the kind of fable like or morality tale like like a grander, more epic, more universal approach that the film has towards, like, the ugliness of humanity. Yeah. It would take away from that because it does tackle that in a more generic way. And, you know, you're obviously, just to let you know, you're not going to get any pushback from us regarding The Master. Ryan, wasn't that, like, your favorite?
Yeah, that was that was my number one film of 2012, and then Inherent Vice ultimately was like my number one of 2014. So, like, you're not going to get any pushback on that one. But
none of us are going to be like the Master.
But The Master, like, despite, like, you know, you definitely can find the deep flaws in both Lancaster Dodd and Freddie Quill. But, like, that movie's ultimately about two men looking for a connection, whatever way they can. And so, so there is that inherent, like, despite the cold distance, there is, like, a, like, that last scene, like, that second to last scene in that movie just gets me every single time.
The slow boat to China,
it's just like,
that's great.
It destroys me. So, like, you're not going to get any pushback from us on that.
Also, you know, when The Master came out, it was a lot of, like, there was a lot of talk about the whole, like, riffing on Scientology aspect. But I feel like, as much as it obviously, like, takes the piss out of Scientology, rightly so, like, I think Anderson's attitude toward religion, The Master, is, I feel that he's a bit more respectful of religion in The Master, insofar as, like, you see what this organized religion does for Freddie Quell, who is this rootless, disturbed war veteran, if I remember all my details correctly, that feels like he's
suffering from PTSD, basically.
PTSD, yeah, that's right. And that he finds this kind of family with this group of nutty people. this religion's obviously bullshit, but it means something to Freddie, and I guess also to Lancaster as well. So I feel maybe it's, obviously this may all just be down to personal preference, but I find something, I guess, maybe more clarifying in that than I have with There Will Be Blood, for all its obvious aesthetic strengths. And I mean, you certainly won't get any argument from me about, like, especially the Johnny Greenwood score. Like, both those scores are great. But
Technically, that movie is, for me, it's pitch perfect.
I totally am on board with that. It's just that I find There Will Be Blood, I just
don't care much about the character or what happens.
Well, I don't demand that I have to care about the characters. It's just that maybe it's just, like, for me, the film's reach, its grand reach has always exceeded its grasp. That's the way I've always felt about There Will Be Blood.
Well, that was Roger Ebert's initial review. I think that's what he was like. He kind of gave it the same reaction that you're giving it, in a way that it is an incredibly ambitious film, and its reach is basically to tell this very far-reaching tale about the darkness and humanity and how we are just basically wired to self-destruct in many ways.
I mean, again, it's like, for me, like, it's in There Will Be Blood is, in many ways, for me, like, it's a very impressive, like, self-contained object. That's the way I kind of view it. But I guess for me, it's never quite open out to something that I can, like, that brings me, like, a new way of looking at things, like, whatever, like, whether it's, like, capitalism or religion or just, like, I guess, misanthropes. Like, I mean, it feels kind of like confirming a lot of perhaps what I already knew, and thus why. And it just, like, I'm impressed by it, but I guess it doesn't work for me in a way that makes it, like, indelible to me. not at least to the level of, like, you know, like one of the like best film of the 21st century so far, as you know, the New York Times critics recently crowned it. Like, I've never quite been on that bandwagon, but I mean, again, it's like there's certainly a lot to admire about the film, and I rewatching it in preparation for this podcast, you know, I was as impressed as ever by like a lot of the set pieces and Daniel Day-Lewis and the score and all that stuff.
Well, I do love that when a film reaches that sort of like level in the zeitgeist, you know, regarded as a masterpiece, to you know, to have that perspective of like actually like peeling it back and like dissecting it and say, hey, you know, maybe it isn't like, you know, maybe it does have these things that are worth considering, which I'm happy you brought to this conversation. Like, speaking of that New York Times list, you know, I feel that same way about a movie like The Tree of Life. Like, I've always thought it was ambitious, appreciate it, but have never like really like fully given myself up to that movie. So like, I totally see where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Well, I always understand when films with such a wide grasp, no matter how much I connect to it on a personal level, when films like that don't connect with other people, because they are really just they're approaching these themes in such a grand scale that it makes it harder to please everybody in a way.
Yeah, and hey, like, no artist is under any obligation to please everyone. So nope. Like, I mean, Anderson like obviously settled on this particular approach.
But
for
maybe
this,
I
though.
Should have said like connected. Like, it doesn't have to. Like, it can't connect with everybody when you have such a grander kind of grasp.
And with a character like Plainview, obviously, not everyone obviously is going to connect with him. But
point is that hopefully you're not supposed to connect with him.
Right. Well, some people may find something interest about him, I guess, in spite of the awful things he does. And maybe I haven't quite gotten to that point as much as I'm enthralled with Day-Lewis's like flamboyance in the role.
Yeah. Well, there are a disturbing amount of people who idolize that character for all the wrong reasons. Kind of like people do with Scarface or Tony Montana. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and I think, you know, as a bit of a segue, I would put up The Wolf of Wall Street, for example, as an example of that.
Yes,
that film is like so fastly paced and so much fun and so funny that you can kind of mistake it for like that it's glorifying its subject matter, but actually what it's doing is it's relentlessly mocking it. So you always run the risk of doing something like that. But what do you guys think? Do you guys want to like move on to the underrated? So let's move on to our underrated pick, which is also Kenji's pick. It is the 2004 Martin Scorsese directed, Leonardo DiCaprio starring, Howard Hughes biopic, The Aviator.
Look, take a couple hours off, all right? You relax a little.
Okay.
See your wife.
Okay.
Show me all the blueprints.
All right.
Blueprints. Yeah, blueprints. I'm serious now. Show me all the blueprints. Show me all the blueprints. Show me all the blueprints.
And Kenji, why did you pick this as your underrated?
Partly because I did want to grapple, since you offered me this opportunity to grapple with There Will Be Blood. I recently revisited The Aviator not too long ago, and one of the things that I thought about in my head was how much it felt like, in some ways, Scorsese was kind of exploring a similar character to what Anderson would tackle with Daniel Plainview in There Will Be Blood, and doing it like years before he did. So I felt like it would be a natural a juxtaposition for this conversation. And I guess I should preface by saying that I like the movie quite a bit, The Aviator. I wouldn't necessarily say it's like a great film necessarily, especially since you mentioned The Wolf of Wall Street. I feel like to some degree that The Wolf of Wall Street is perhaps an even better film about a capitalist monster.
Oh, thank you. I was definitely going to bring that up. So
yeah. I was too. So good call.
But I feel like I feel like it might be worth perhaps rescuing the reputation of The Aviator a bit, just because I feel just because of how much I feel Howard Hughes, at least as he's characterized in this film and in John Logan's script and in Scorsese's direction and Leonardo DiCaprio's performance, how much he does fit in with Scorsese's macho his macho protagonists, say Jordan Belfort in Wolf of Wall Street, but also like all many of the male characters in Goodfellas who seem to only be, I think this is like classic Pauline Kael characterization. They only know how to do one thing: steal. And Howard Hughes, at least as portrayed in this film, only knows how to do one thing, and it's make money, mm-hmm. make a lot of money. And but I feel like it does fit in with Scorsese's filmography quite handsomely, even despite its circumstances. Because I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, this was technically like a work for hire, right? Because Michael Mann was originally supposed to direct mm-hmm. this, and then Scorsese took over. But I still see a lot of Scorsese's personality in this.
Big time.
And of course, he's working in a more like, I guess, popular style. Like, this is a very lavish period epic, and in some ways it speaks to not only, I guess, Scorsese's interest in classic cinema, classic Hollywood cinema, but also I guess just like Hughes's own grandiosity. Like, this is a guy that was willing to, among other things, like reshoot a whole film when, if I remember correctly, when sounds came in.
Yeah, talkies became the thing. He reshot the whole thing. He
reshot the whole film and was willing to waste a lot of money in order to get that that dogfight in Hell's Angels just right.
Well, the driving theme is obviously ambition.
Yeah.
And his ambition also feeds his OCD, is that everything has to be perfect, that kind of like everything has to be perfect attitude, where he's kind of tragically stuck in the... I really love the last couple of minutes of this film because of the way that it just kind of anticlimactically for this lavish biopic genre just kind of fizzles out.
Right.
No, it just kind of goes, tells you where this is going.
It gives you that like triumphant moment when he lands the spruce, he flies the spruce goose, but mm-hmm. it complicates that with, it leaves you not with that, but with him saying the way of the future repeatedly and thus mm-hmm. paving the way for, among other things, Warren Beatty's Howard Hughes in Rules Don't Apply.
Which I haven't seen. Ryan, did you see that?
No, I didn't see it.
One reason why I was interested in revisiting The Aviator too back in December was like Rules Don't Apply had just come out, and so there were a lot of chatter about Howard Hughes, and it also like I actually wrote something up for Brooklyn Magazine, like just a short capsule review. It was timed for a screening of The Aviator at the Museum of the Moving Image here in New York. So like it was my reason for revisiting it. Interesting film. I can't, at least Rules Don't Apply. Like I guess it's kind of like a tangent, but yeah, I can't quite get on board with the people that say it's like some kind of underrated like messy masterpiece, something as some people have said. But it's an interesting film. I guess I just wanted to talk about The Aviator for this episode because for one thing, now obviously that beginning scene in the film, the quarantine scene, I mean obviously that's a bit of like dime store psychology to pin all that to just that one thing. So I guess for me it does suggest a bit of perhaps what I find missing in There Will Be Blood. It's like it's kind of like The Aviator does offer like its own version of Rosebud, whereas Anderson, and obviously deliberately, I'm sure, but like he doesn't even bother to give you the Rosebud, which I mean, I guess it's fine. It perhaps points to why I've always found that frustrating. But
Ryan, do you want to jump in?
Sure, I'll jump in here. I hadn't seen the movie since 2004, so it had been a while. I certainly like it. I'm glad you brought up Wolf of Wall Street. I'd even probably, at least the beginning of this movie, throw a little Great Gatsby in there as far as like lavish period pieces starring Leonardo DiCaprio. Yeah. But this movie does kind of plays a little like a double feature for me, especially in hindsight. Like, you have the exceptionalism and the capitalism that Scorsese did very well with Wolf of Wall Street. And I feel like this movie also reminds me a lot of Hugo, because I think there is a lot of starry-eyed love for the past and for his love of classical cinema that shines through a lot of that first hour of the movie.
Those two kind of clash, don't they?
They do at times. Like, I prefer the back half of this movie to the first half of it. But at least for a while, you're like, okay, like, because at first it is a very typically structured biopic with Scorsese's flair. Like, there's tracking shots for days, and the cutting of the lights of the cameras shattering, like, you know, stuff like that. But they do clash for a while, because it's like you're building up this story about American exceptionalism, but also sort of glorifying the, you know, again, with that starry-eyed aspect. But then when it takes that turn after the pretty brutal plane crash, which still, like, it shocked me then, and it still was like, I'm like, oh man, that's really brutal for a PG-13 movie. And then it sort of does take that sort of turn into madness, but also just this sort of like sad reality that this character is now living in. And I think that that half is stronger. But this movie, especially like Robert Richardson's cinematography, like the color palette that they went with, it's a beautiful movie. Like, it's a undeniably beautiful movie.
In some ways, he's a bit too enamored with Howard Hughes as a figure, and you can totally understand Scorsese being first and foremost an old Hollywood nerd. You can see why he would be kind of really into Howard Hughes, and the film almost comes across as like this passion project, which makes it interesting to find out that he was a bit of a gun for hire for this. It looks like with Scorsese's love for old Hollywood, you would think that this was like a 20-plus year passion project in the making, the way that Gangs of New York was. So there's this kind of clashing between, he wants you to kind of empathize with him, he wants you to kind of be in awe of his kind of insane achievements, and he kind of lulls you into that during the first half. And I do agree with Ryan that I prefer the second half a bit more, because that's when the kind of darkness sets in. That's when you start realizing how this kind of like self-centered perfectionism can really get in the way, and you can like really ruin other people's lives, and people are just kind of like the company. Like, we don't really get to see it, but we're always here like how much, like, the company's always at the verge of bankruptcy, and he's employing like thousands and thousands of people.
Yeah, he doesn't care.
Yeah, he doesn't care. These people's lives are going to be ruined. He doesn't care. He doesn't act like a CEO. He acts like a king. Just like, I want. And then at times, this kind of approach, his narcissism turns into kind of like, he starts acting like a toddler in some ways. So in this, while we lived through this administration, it was an interesting film to watch for sure. And I think partly the reason why like it was harder this time around for me to like really connect with the film, I hadn't seen it since 2004 either. And part of the reason was just like, I don't want to watch like at least the first hour and a half. I was like, I don't want to watch like a fawning, romanticized approach to a narcissistic, childlike rich person's life, you know, like it's like a kind of a personal thing these days. that's not Scorsese's fault in any way, but yeah, he does kind of tip it after the halfway point, and it becomes a more interesting film in the way that it I would give it to you that he does give us the Rosebud moment, and he does kind of create a bit more of a, how should I say, like, level-headed approach to capitalism, the way that it's its approach and its approach to its themes are a lot more connected to Citizen Kane than it is to There'll Be Blood, where he tries to like genuinely get into the mind of this character and what drove him, what propelled him. And almost like Aviator embodies the idea, the famous line from Citizen Kane, which is, you can make a lot of money if all you want to do is make a lot of money. Yeah. And it kind of like captures that. That's all he's driven for. That's all he's going for. That's why all of his relationships fail. And he becomes like more and more of a recluse because he has trouble finding anybody who can even keep up with his kind of perfectionist madness. And that becomes more and more of a thing. So the approach is right. What I find kind of dull is the execution. It is a bit of an overlong film in some ways, and in some ways it is too short, because I feel like this could have been like either a great shorter feature or like a 10-hour miniseries, which back then that wasn't, of course, a possibility. But now you kind of think about like he could have, I could kind of see Scorsese taking this to HBO or Netflix, where those kind of like giant budget things like spread out over like 9-10 hours, like actually fly now, no pun intended. So I kind of have this kind of approach to it. I was like, it's kind of stuck in between because it doesn't really, you know, I would almost prefer like a feature that focused on one of the aspects that it deals with. Either the whole production of Hell's Angels could have made for like a great 2-hour movie. That stuff is fascinating. Or the whole like building of the plane. Like if you just focused on the building of the plane, that could have been like the Lincoln approach. Like Lincoln is a kind of a biopic, but it's all about the ratification of the 13th Amendment, right?
Right.
I didn't grow up in the States, so I never took civics classes
right.
here.
Sure, yeah.
So I think the kind of a Lincoln approach to The Aviator, I think, could have worked better because you don't really get to spend enough time for me to sink your teeth into one particular thing. You're kind of like moving right along, which, you know, this movie, I think as long as it is, it shouldn't have been longer than that anyway. So I understand. But maybe a bit more of a focused approach sprawling biopic approach maybe could have worked.
I had no idea that this was originally going to be Michael Mann. Now saying that, I would have loved to see what he would have done with this movie. Just the way that he both like revels in and critiques like toxic masculinity, like all in the same vein, would have been like really fascinating to see.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing is for me about The Aviator is I guess I see it as also like Scorsese's attempt to you talk about how he comes close to like glorifying the Hughes character before he goes off the deep end with his OCD and his
there's certainly more complex empathy here than There'll Be Blood.
I feel like all the loving period recreations, to some degree one could perhaps read that as Scorsese's own attempt to get inside Hughes's, get inside his head, while not necessarily like, it's also playing a similar kind of like tricky balancing act. He's trying to like embody this figure while also perhaps trying to stand a bit above it. So you get to see the lavish lifestyle that he lives. But there are, even then, there are moments here and there like that whole montage when he's on the sequence where he's at the premiere of Hell's Angels on the red carpet, where you feel just how like with all the flashes going, the way like Thelma Schoonmaker edits all that together, you really,
especially with his OCD, you kind of feel for him in that moment.
Obviously you're not really meant to necessarily identify with this character either, but like, I mean, even in films like Goodfellas or like Raging Bull, there's always like, Scorsese, I feel, has always been kind of like, there is a certain level of wary admiration to these rather terrible people, but there's just something about them that fascinates him, whether it's like the high flying lifestyle that Henry Hill wants to bask in Goodfellas, and the way like Scorsese shoots all that, you certainly like feel that. While even as a lot of that goes haywire later on when the chickens come home to roost, more or less, and even then, who knows if Henry Hill actually learns anything at the end of that movie.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like he does, and that's what makes Scorsese so special, especially when dealing with such kind of despicable characters, is that he always finds a way for you to empathize and relate to these characters on a base level. And Goodfellas is a great example of that, and that's part of the reason why I love Wolf of Wall Street so much, is because it's so refreshing in the way that you don't get any of that with his approach to Jordan Belfort. Like, you can tell that he just straight up hates this guy. the Wolf of Wall Street really doesn't have it's boastful and it's like stylish and all that, and like it captures his point of view, his gaudy point of view, but also it doesn't like really give him much of an inch towards he understands where he's coming from, but he doesn't like really, there's no awe involved. There's no he's not impressed, basically.
And that exists
with The Aviator for sure, that there is this like level of awe that he puts into Howard Hughes. But also, like you said, the thing that I admire about it is that he never really lets you off. Like, you gave the example of the premiere. That's supposed to be like another director would have turned that into like a lavish kind of like very high moment for the character. Everything is going great. And you're supposed to, it's this moment where it's like all the hard work of the character is paying off, and the audience is supposed to be kind of envious of the character. And even in moments like that, he shows you that when you're this kind of a personality, nothing is going to be enough. You're never going to get to a point where you're going to be satisfied. So even even at this point where it's just like, it's supposed to be like the culmination of his hard work, he's still uneasy and he's still not satisfied. And that kind of course, pays off at the end of that scene where he's like, yeah, we're reshooting the whole thing. You know, it's all about talkies now. And that's when you start to realize, like, yeah, this guy's never going to stop the way that Daniel Plainview is never going to stop. But at least, yeah, in the case of The Aviator, it is more of a personal kind of biopic story, which kind of strips it away from being, like, having that kind of gorgeous and impactful kind of fable, like human fable quality that There Will Be Blood has.
You know, it is a different kind of movie. Yeah, but that's not necessarily a knock on either film. I guess there's a certain like fundamental honesty about Scorsese's approach, like his very much admiring, but also like wary approach to this character. I find a certain honesty in that. So while I certainly get the ambivalence about it, like especially in our current political climate, I guess to some degree I kind of, in a sense, maybe just refreshingly honest of him to admit that. And I mean, it's and it certainly is impressive to watch.
It will be hard to imagine like a film like There Will Be Blood made by Scorsese, because he's such a deeply empathetic filmmaker that he would find a way to dig deep into even kind of an irredeemable character like Daniel Plainview to figure out like where he's really coming from. And that's what's so special about Scorsese. That's why his spiritually packed films like Last Temptation of Christ, Kundun, and recently Silence, I have so much respect for, because he does such an amazing job of like in just approaching these subjects in a deeply emotional yet very level-headed way. And he that's why he's so he's one of our greatest American filmmakers living today. Ryan, what do you think about do you agree with me when I say that the film Aviator specifically has some pacing issues, where it should have been shorter, or should have been a either that or it should have been a miniseries or something like that.
Well, I mean, I think it's, I mean, yeah, I just flat out yes, because you brought up Lincoln. I'd also say Selma would be another good example of like taking a historical figure and just carving out a moment in their time, a moment in their history to focus on. Because it is hard anymore, especially, like, again, this wouldn't have happened in 2004, but in this day and age, when you can do, like, the 8-part, 10-part miniseries, you know, a story like this, you know, you don't see the long epic biopics anymore. And, like, really,
that's true.
Like, and even, like, the good ones, as recently, like, Straight Outta Compton, a movie I really, really liked. I feel like I would have watched a 10-hour version of that if they were able to make that. So I do think that the movie has pacing issues from that side, but not from Scorsese's side, because the guy knows how to pace a movie and has never made his movies that are 3 hours or near 3 hours, like this and Casino and Wolf of Wall Street, always feel like they just fly by. Like he just has a way of doing that. So I don't think the movie itself has inherent pacing issues, but yeah, it could have benefited from a different approach. But it doesn't mean that it's a less, like Kenji said, it's still a very fascinating movie. And I like that they do, you know, that there's both that there's an admittance to both admiring, but also coming down on Howard Hughes at the same time. I think there's also a lot of like good supporting performances in the movie too. I also think there's a lot of distracting ones.
Yep.
At the same time, I think John C. Reilly and Adam Scott and Matt Ross are great.
Kate Blanchett is divine.
She's divine. Well, she's divine. At first she's a little caricature-y, but like they really get
it's a
into
bit
that.
Of mimicry. It comes across
at first, yeah. but when they get into that character, she's really terrific. I think Jude Law, Gwen Stefani, and Kate Beckinsale are incredibly distracting in the movie, more than they serve a purpose. But they're fine. They're fine when they show up.
The characters don't really serve much of a purpose, but I do like Kate Beckinsale's take on Ava Gardner. It's not as much mimicry, for example, as Kate Blanchett is. It's a bit more of a nuanced take on the sultriness of Ava Gardner.
Right. Or Jude Law's Errol Flynn, who just shows up briefly.
Yeah, totally pointless. I don't know what the hell that was about.
These are probably script, like concessions to like a certain breed of like Hollywood biopic, like, as is like a lot of the issues you all speak of, which I won't necessarily disagree with.
Right.
But again, like Ryan said, like you say, Ryan, like, yeah, like Scorsese, with what you got, what he worked with, he knows how to pace a film. And for me, even these 3 packed hours, just like it just flies by, I guess, pun intended.
Yeah.
So
lots of flying puns today.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we're at a point where we can start wrapping up the episode. I think we went through a lot of interesting recommendations for sure, of films about good old American ambition and capitalism. So you can basically listen to this episode and then just rent or buy a bunch of movies and throw your own kind of American capitalism festival, starting with There'll Be Blood, The Master, Wolf of Wall Street, The Aviator, Goodfellas, probably you can throw in there. It's a lot of different, lot of interesting options there. But
where we are now through all these films.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. They're very important for that matter. Yeah, if you want to find out how we got to this shithole, just take a look at how we got there through the 20th century. So this has been yet another one. Whenever we anticipate kind of like a contentious, you know, oh, you picked Darby Blood, that movie's a masterpiece, how dare you, kind of thing, and then, you know, as usual, it usually comes out very civil, and this has been a very fun little interesting little discussion. And thank you so much for joining in, Kenji, and
thanks for having me.
Yeah, and so thank you so much for listening to another episode of Over Under Movies. We are hosted by the Playlist Podcast Network, and you can find us and other shows like Adjust Your Tracking and Bingeworthy and the general Playlist Podcast, which Ryan appears from time to time, on the playlist.net on the podcast tab. You can also find us on iTunes. You can find us. Ryan, do you know if we're on Stitcher?
We're on Stitcher and we're on SoundCloud as well.
Yeah, you can find us on Stitcher and SoundCloud. Specifically for Over Under Movies podcast, you can follow us on facebook.com/overundermovies, and we are on Twitter at overundermovies. And for the next episode, we usually kind of tease our picks, but they're going to be my picks this time around. But this time we're going to kind of leave you with a little bit of mystery, because I'm trying to see if I can get another one of our previous guests to join in a an episode, and if that happens, I'm gonna have a different set of picks than the ones that I have in mind. So we'll see in a couple of weeks, and hopefully that's gonna be a pleasant surprise. So without further ado, signing off here, it's Oktay Ege Kozak. I'm a film critic and contributor for The Playlist, Paste Magazine, DVD Talk, and BeyazParda.com.
Signing off is Ryan Oliver. I'm co-host of this podcast as well as the general Playlist podcast.
And this is Kenji Fujishima. I am a contributor to Village Voice, Paste Magazine, Slant Magazine. I think that's about it. And also recently a copy editor / newswriter for TheaterMania.com. So I cover all different arts and culture areas.
Oh yeah, so check that out, theatermania.com. Thank you so much, guys, for joining in, and we'll see you next time.